I say unto you, lecture number 14, 5th of November, 1977, Akipa Guanshi Rajneesh Ashram, Pune.
The first question. What is the difference between great sexual suppression and freedom from sex? On the surface, both have no interest in sex. How does suppressed sex bubble up? First, the suppressed sex has more interest than the expressed sex can ever have. The interest is not direct, it is indirect, it is vicarious, it is cunning. The interest is there, immensely there. If your sex life is normal, unrepressed, uninhibited, interest cannot be so much. Because you will have a kind of satisfaction, a contentment. It is like you have taken your food, you forget about food. But if you fast, then you continuously think about food. Fast one day and then go to the market. And you will see only hotels, restaurants, food stores. And you will smell only food smells coming from everywhere. And you had been to this place before many times. It had never happened like that. Repression cannot free you from interest. The repressed person becomes more interested in sex than anybody else. Maybe he shows antagonism, that's possible, but antagonism is interest. That's why our so-called religious scriptures are full of antagonism for sex, condemnation. Your so-called Mahatmas go on cursing sex, that simply shows their interest, nothing else. They are still haunted by it. They may be sitting in their caves in the Himalayas, but they are condemning sex. Why? It is deep inside them, in their very guts. They are fighting with it. Their condemnation is a way of their fighting with it. They condemn it so that they can remain on top of it. If you don't condemn for even a single day, they start feeling afraid. The real thing from inside may surface, may throw them away, and their control, and their saintlyhood, and their holiness. And the more you repress, the more it accumulates. It becomes more and more powerful. So the first thing to understand, it is impossible for a repressed person not to show interest. He will show disinterest, but that is interest, upside down. And if you watch, you will see it coming everywhere. A normal sexual life has sex in a normal way. Sometimes it takes possession of you, and it is beautiful to be possessed by it. Because to be possessed by any life energy is to be possessed by God. That is the only natural way for ordinary people who are not trying to attain some higher consciousness. who are not going into meditation. That is the only way to have a taste of meditation. When sex possesses you, it is God possessing you on the lowest rung, of course. Samadhi is the highest rung of being possessed by God, and sex is the lowest rung by being possessed by God. But in both the ways you are possessed by God. In sex, God has to function through your body. In samadhi, He functions through your soul. In music, in art, in poetry, in dance, He functions through your mind. But whenever you are in a state of let go, whenever you are not, and that is the joy of sex, because you disappear for a moment, that moment is very small, but immense is its impact. For one moment, you are no more the ego. You don't think in terms of I. For one moment, you dissolve into the unity of the all. You become one with the whole. You pulsate with the whole. You are no more an individual. You are no more confined to your body. You don't know limitations. For a moment you are unlimited, infinite. That is the meaning of sexual orgasm. That your frozen energy melts, becomes one with this universe, with the trees and the stars and the woman and the man and the rocks. For a single moment, of course. But in that moment, you have a kind of consciousness that is religious, that is holy, because it comes from the whole. The attraction for sex is attraction for God. The attraction for sex is the attraction to let go. There is nothing wrong in it. It is the beginning of the search for God. And of course, the beginning can begin where you are. You are in the body. So only in the body the search can start. It should not remain there, that's true, but it cannot start anywhere else. You have to go rung by rung, step by step. The higher you move, the lower it starts becoming meaningless. Not that you are against it, but because you are gaining higher ecstasies. Who bothers about the lower? The man who is against sex is below sex. He has fallen below sex. He is obsessed with sex. 24 hours will be full of sexual thoughts, fantasies. And you can watch. Everywhere he will show his fantasy, his repression. You can see him walking on the road. He will not be able to walk naturally. A beautiful woman passes by, then what you do if you are carrying great repression? Trembling comes in him. He starts looking the other way. Or he escapes into a small street to avoid. He cannot look at the woman. By not looking, he is showing where he is interested at. But by not looking, he is showing his interest. The man who is above sex, the man who has become free of sex, avoids nothing. He has no antagonism about sex. He will have compassion for all those who are still in the world of sex. And the man who has gone beyond sex will look at the beautiful woman, and the beautiful woman would not remind him of sex, but of God. Because all reminds him of God. A beautiful flower reminds him of God. A beautiful face reminds him of God. In fact, all reminds him of God. A man went to his psychiatrist, and the psychiatrist was trying to find out what is his problem. And psychiatrist, psychologist, psychoanalyst, they have stumbled upon one great fact about humanity, that 99 problems arise out of sex. Not because of sex, but because of your religious conditioning against sex. So the doctor was trying to find out from where the problem are arising. He asked the man, when you see a tree, what it reminds you of? And the man said, of sex. Tree? Of sex? To be more certain, the doctor asked, and when you see stars, what it reminds you of? And the man said, of course, of sex. And the doctor, to be still more certain, asked, when you see a camel walking by, what it reminds you of? And the man said, of sex. And the doctor said, camel? Reminding you of sex? And the man said, yes, everything reminds me of sex. It is not a question of camel or tree or the elephant or the dog. Everything reminds me of sex. If you are obsessed, repressed, everything will remind you of sex. Everything. Because you are carrying such a load, you will go on projecting. There is no need for a real woman to be there, just a sari hanging will do. There is no need for a real woman there, just one of my long-haired sannyasins going by, and from the back you see, and those long hairs, and it is there. You cannot get beyond sex by repressing it. The way beyond is through. The way beyond is through understanding. I have heard several men who had been involved in a serious road accident were brought to hospital on stretchers, and the dead were separated from the living. One of those believed to be dead had been accompanied by his wife, who was mainly interested in the insurance money to which his death would entitle her. As soon as she arrived, therefore, she approached one of the harassed doctors dealing with the emergency, and pointing to her husband on his stretcher said, "He is dead, is not he, doctor?" "I am afraid so, madam," said the doctor, incautiously assuming that the judgment of the stretcher bearers as to who was dead and who was not had been correct. At this moment, the woman's supposedly dead husband, who was in fact alive and had overheard the conversation, suddenly sat up on his stretcher and said, "I am not dead, doctor." "Lie down," snapped his wife. "The doctor knows." Now, her interest is in the insurance money. It shows. You cannot hide it. It will show in some way or other. It will erupt out of you. You must have heard about great rishis and mahatmas doing their meditations in the forest. And then apsaras, beautiful damsels from heaven come to distract them. But why these beautiful women should be interested in distracting these poor people who are not doing any harm to anybody. They are just sitting under their trees, doing their japa, their meditation. Why anybody should be interested in distracting them? Indian scriptures are full of these stories. But nobody asks why in the first place. Why God should run a portfolio, a special department to distract these poor, fasting, meditating people. But they come. And those beautiful women dance naked around. And they hug the Mahatmas. And they try to distract them from their meditations. These women are not coming from heaven. Heaven has no interest. Heaven really should be rejoiced that another man is coming higher, reaching to heaven. It is not very much populated. Heaven is very much uncrowded, almost a desert, because people go to hell. God should be rejoiced. The angels should dance and sing that a new guest is coming. There should be sensation in heaven. Why they should send beautiful women to distract? And in the first place, where they can find the beautiful women? They all go to hell. In heaven, what they are doing with beautiful women? But they come. They don't come from heaven. They come from the unconscious, repressed sexuality. If you fast, if you torture your body, if you go on repressing your natural desires, a moment comes when you are so much full of it that the fantasy looks almost real. Then you cannot make any distinction between the fantasy and the real. Then the imagination looks objective. You are in a kind of hallucination. These are hallucinations. No, you say, what is the difference between great sexual suppression and freedom from sex? The differentiation is great. The difference is that the man who has repressed his sex will remain continuously giving signals about his sexuality and obsession. He will continuously talk against it. He will condemn it. He will never be able to forgive anybody for being sexual. Just the word is enough to trigger his anger and hatred. If he sees two persons in a loving state, he will be off his rockers. Just 2 days before it happened, one Shankaracharya came to see me. Now this is the last place for Shankaracharyas to come. He was staying with a doctor in Pune, and the doctor is interested in me, and he must have persuaded the old poor man that you come. Somehow he managed and brought him on the gate. He was sitting in the car. The doctor had gone to the office to arrange for the meeting. When he went back, Shankaracharya was very angry. And he said, take me away from this place immediately. The doctor said, what has happened? He said, look, sannyasins, men and women holding hands. I cannot remain here a single moment. This is not a holy place. This is against religion and against culture. He really got very much irritated. The doctor wrote a letter to me that I had never seen him in such anger. He was in a rage, murderous rage. Now from where it is coming? Why? You should be worried if some man and woman are holding hands. This is none of your business. They are not forcing you to do anything. They are just going on their way. They have not even looked at you. They are not in rage about you. Why? You should be in rage about him, about them. But this is not the question about them. The repressed sexuality is provoked. Seeing a beautiful woman holding somebody's hand, jealousy arises. To repress that jealousy, sex starts bubbling up. To repress that sex, one has to be very, very angry. Only through anger you can repress sex. People who repress sex become angry. Have you watched it? Become irritated. Small things irritate them. They are never at ease. Always in anger. Have you seen people who have repressed sex? They become aggressive. And they start finding ways and means how to express their aggression. They become politicians. They become money oriented. They have to find some way for their aggression. It may be politics, it may be money, it may be some other kind of ambition, but they become very, very aggressive. And have you known this too, or not? That if you want to earn money, you will have to repress sex. If you don't repress sex, you will not have enough aggression left to fight in the market, to compete with people. If you want to become a great politician, you will have to repress sex. Otherwise, from where you will find this stupid energy to be a politician? You have to repress sexuality. So energy starts becoming more and more accumulated in you. And finding no natural way, it is ready to go into any way, into any channelization where you want it to go. A man who has repressed sex is not uninterested in sex. No, not at all. He is more interested than the ordinary man. His whole interest is centered there. He is continuously afraid of sex, afraid of beauty, afraid of bodies, afraid of his dreams. He cannot sleep well. He cannot communicate well, because everything reminds him of sex. And it is not only that women, if you repress sex towards women long enough, you will start turning homosexual. Even men will remind you of sex and nothing else. If camels can remind you of sex, then why not men? People who repress sex are going to have great difficulties, are going to be perverted. Men will remind. Everything by and by will start having a sexual tinge and color. Beware of it. Do you know Alexander the Great was a homosexual? Julius Caesar was a homosexual. And many other great kings and generals have been homosexuals. Reason? Continuously fighting, continuously on the move, on the front, battling. Women not available. Sex starts turning towards homosexuality. Soldiers, people in the army, navy, air force start turning homosexuals. Monks, nuns, start being homosexual or lesbians, because monks are not allowed any woman in the monastery. Now, there are monasteries in Europe where for 1,000 years not a single woman has entered, not even a small baby of 7 days old. No. Now, what will happen there? 1,000 monks in the monastery, and once you enter in the monastery, you are not allowed to get out of it. You enter forever. Mount Athos is such a monastery. You enter once forever. It is like the grave. Then you never come out of it. Sometimes people come out of graves too. But nobody comes out of Mount Athos. And no woman ever has crossed the threshold. Not even a small baby. The limit is 7 days. More than 7 days old small baby is dangerous. What kind of people are living there? Just think of an 8 days old girl. These people must be great Mahatmas. The same Mahatmas the scriptures talk about, to whom damsels and beautiful Apsaras come to distract. Now even an 8 days old baby is not allowed. It is against the code of the monastery. When these 1,000 people live in a completely boys' club, naturally the repressed sexuality starts turning into homosexuality. Nuns start turning into lesbians. This goes on. This has been so down the ages. That's why I don't like my ashram to be monosexual, only man or only woman. I want man and woman mix, meet. I want this place to be very natural, healthy, whole. Only then you can go beyond it, otherwise not. And the man who has gone beyond sex is free from sex to say that he has no interest in sex is also wrong. His interest is not personal anymore. He has no involvement, that is true. But he is interested in everything, in the flowers, in the birds, in the animals, in the people. He is interested in everything. His interest is not personal. No involvement on his own being. But he is interested in everything. If such a man looks, a couple looking into each other's eyes, he will be happy. He will thank God. He has seen love energy moving. He will bless this couple. He will say, go ahead. This is the way. Enjoy these moments. He will show no obsession this way or that. He will not start thinking of possessing this woman. And he will not start thinking how to escape from this situation, because he has no fear. He can bless the couple. It happens every day. Couples come to me. Sometimes Indians are also there. They become very much puzzled, because Indians cannot think that any sage will give any advice about sex too. They cannot conceive. They think a sage only talks about God, only about God. When I advise people on their ordinary life problems, Indians who have never heard Buddha advising anybody are Mahavira advising anybody, even about their sexual problems, feel very uneasy, embarrassed. They cannot understand what is happening. They expect from me only advice about God, meditation and things like that. I should not help a couple in their problems. But how this couple is going to become meditating? If this couple is involved, entangled in sexuality, is not helped to go beyond it, how it is possible someday for them to become meditative? I have to take their whole life, and I take great interest in every kind of problem. I get completely lost in their problems. I become completely absorbed. I forget the whole world. When somebody is facing me with his problem, that his problem is my whole world. Whatsoever the problem, whether it is sex, whether it is money, whether it is overeating, whether it is body, health, meditation, God, prayer, it does not matter. Whatsoever it is, the person has a problem, and the problem has to be solved, and I have to bring all my energy to solve it. I am utterly interested in everything, because I am not afraid of anything. Why I should not be interested? But remember, the interest has a totally different meaning. I am interested in a flower. I am interested in beauty. I am interested in beauty, in poetry, in music, in dance. I am interested in all kinds of possibilities. And God too is interested. Otherwise sex would have disappeared long before. Why sex should continue? If Mahatmas are right, then God is wrong. George Gurdjieff used to say that your so-called Mahatmas are all against God, and your so-called religions are all against God. And he is right. He has something very significant to say there. They are, because God goes on creating the world. And God goes on creating the world in such a variety, in such richness, in all directions, dimensions. And Mahatmas are monotonous. They say just simply do the japa, repeat Ram, Ram, Ram. Go on repeating. The life of a Mahatma is a very poor life. No richness, no inner variety, no dimensions to his being. He is linear, one-dimensional. The man who is free of sex has no personal involvement in it. He has no desire for it. Not that he is against it, just his desires have moved higher. It is like a child. You were once a child, and you used to play with colored stones, used to collect on the sea beach shells and stones. Then one day, you became a grown-up. Now you don't collect. But if your child is collecting sea shells and colored stones, won't you be able to understand him? Won't you show interest? Won't you say to the child, good, this stone is beautiful. Where did you find it? Even I had not found such stones when I was young, and like you, was searching and exploring sea beaches. You are fortunate. You will not condemn the child. You will not say, this is nonsense, rubbish. Throw these stones. I know they mean nothing. You will show all interest. That is really grown-upness. If you start shouting at the child and you say, this is nonsense and rubbish, throw all these stones, don't carry them. They will dirty your clothes, your pockets. Your pockets will lose shape, this and that. And your mom will be very, very angry. Throw them. I have known through my own experience that they are meaningless. That simply shows you are not yet mature enough. Maturity is enough maturity only when it can accept the immature. Maturity is real maturity when it cannot only accept the immature but can bless them with all the hopes that you will grow out of this. Everybody grows, just time is needed. You had a teddy bear or a toy that you had loved so much that there was days you could not sleep without it. You had to carry it to the bed. You had to carry it to journeys. Your parents were feeling a little embarrassed that you have carried this big teddy bear with you and this big toy and you have become a big boy now or a big girl. Stop it. But you had to carry it everywhere. And then one day suddenly something changed. The teddy bear got lost. It remained for a few days in the corner of your room. Then you threw it out into the rubbish heap. What happened? How you got rid of it? You became mature. You have not repressed the desire. You have not repressed your love affair with the teddy bear. You have simply grown up. You have gone beyond. Freedom of sex is not repression of sex. It is understanding of sex. And through understanding one goes beyond. But that does not mean that you will be angry and against and antagonistic. You will be blissful. You will have a blessing for everybody. And you will bless with the hope that someday you will also go beyond it. Real religion has to be rooted in the earth. Yes, real religion also has to rise towards the sun. It is like a lotus flower, rooted in the mud and rising towards the sun. The lotus has to be freed from the mud. But the mud has not to be condemned at all, because the mud is the nourishment. Your sex energy is the nourishment for your samadhi. It is out of the mud of sex that the lotus of samadhi is going to bloom. Never repress it. Never be against it. Rather, go deep into it with great clarity, with great love. Go like an explorer. Search all nooks and corners of your sexuality and you will be surprised and enriched and benefited. Knowing your sexuality, you will stumble one day upon your spirituality. Then you become free. Your energy has risen high. Now sex is just like a toy. But you are not angry with other people who are still playing with the toy. You will understand them too. You will have compassion for them. You would like to help them go beyond. But you will not condemn them and you will not like to throw them to hell to be punished. They are not doing anything wrong. Sex is not a sin. Nobody is ever punished for sex. Nobody ever goes to the hell for sex. Otherwise, God will be responsible, not you. He has given it to you. You are born with it. You have not created it. It is nothing like your invention. It is not like atom bomb. It is not like a bayonet. It is not like a sword. It is not like money. It is not like politics. These people are inventions of man, of the ugly human mind. These people will go to hell, certainly. But sex is a God-given gift. And it is a great seed. And in the seed is hidden samadhi. Once it starts sprouting, it finds the right soil, it will become a big tree. Millions of flowers will come to it. It is not only that out of sex a child is born. It is out of sex that you will be reborn too. Sex is generating force. Sex is the very source of creativity. It is out of sex new life is born. You will give birth to a child. This is new life. God coming in another garb, another manifestation, another incarnation of God in your child. But it comes through sex. Just watch it. Sex must be immensely valuable. God has chosen it to be the passage for life. What is more valuable than life? What can be more valuable than life? God has chosen sex as the vehicle for life. Life comes through sex, in sex, out of sex. And those who know, those who have gone beyond this, say, another life, a spiritual life, also comes through it. Not only your child is born through it, you will be reborn through it. You will become twice born through it. You will resurrect out of it. It is life-giving energy. Sex has to be respected. Sex is sacred. Sex is the very temple of God. So I cannot say the man who is free from sex has no interest. Because sex is life. And sex is the potential spirituality. How he can be disinterested in it? Yes, he has no personal interest in it. He has gone beyond it. But he is immensely interested. In fact, a man who is free of sex, his interest becomes very, very great. Now he is interested in everything. When you are obsessed with sex, you are not interested in anything. You are not interested in poetry. You are not interested in music. You are not interested in beauty. You are only interested in sex. And if sometimes you so interest in music, poetry, beauty, art, you so only, because some sexuality is there. You become interested in a poetry if it is sexual. You become interested in a picture, in a painting, if it is nude, pornographic. You become interested in the music if it excites you sexually. Otherwise, you are not interested. This is not interest in music and painting. This is interest in sex. That's why 99% poetry, music, painting and sculpture are sex-based. Because 99% people don't want anything else than sex. Your films, your novels, your books, even your so-called religious books, they are all full of sexuality. Sometimes in the name of condemnation. But they go on talking about the physical, the sexual. Sometimes they are obscene. The man who is free of sex, his interest is also free of sex. His interest is spread to the whole life. Just the other day I was reading, in a school the teacher asked the children, small children, how many stars do you see in the night? One child says, thousands. Another child said, millions. And the third child said, trillions. And then stood the smallest boy in the class and said, three. The teacher asked, three? And these your friends are seeing trillions, millions, thousands, and you see only three? He said, what to do? We have got a very small window. Now the small window becomes the frame. Only three stars. You have a very small window to look at life. That window is called sex. Only three stars. When you are free of sex, you jump out of the window. The whole sky becomes available to you. Those three stars are also there still, but no more prominent. Lost in so many stars. Your interest becomes bigger, infinite. The whole sky becomes your limit. A man who has attained freedom from sex is immensely interested in everything. Everything thrills him. Everything excites him to ecstasy. And everything reminds him of God. The second question, what is hypertension? The hypertension is a state of mind when you have become too much focused on rationality and you have forgotten your feelings. The hypertension comes out of an imbalance. Too much trust in reason is the basis of all hypertension. People who live in their heads become hypertense. Relaxation comes through the heart. One should be capable to move from the head to the heart easily, just as you move out of your house and inside your house. One should be fluid between head and heart. These are two sources of the river you are. You should not become clinging to one source, otherwise life becomes lopsided. The West suffers very much from hypertension because it has forgotten the language of the heart, and only heart knows how to relax, because only heart knows how to love. Only heart knows how to enjoy, celebrate. Only the heart knows how to dance and sing. The head knows nothing of dance. The head condemns dance as stupid. The head knows nothing of poetry. The head condemns poetry. Do you know? One of the greatest philosophers, Plato, thinking about his ultimate utopia, Republic, has said that no poets should be allowed there. In his Republic, in his ultimate state of society, poets should not be allowed. Why? Because he is afraid of poets. He says poets bring fantasies. Poets bring dreams. Poets bring confusion and mysticism. And we don't want any of it. We want a very clear-cut, logical, prose society. That society will be hypertense. Everybody will be neurotic. In Plato's Republic, if it ever happens, and there is every fear that it can happen, everybody will be a neurotic. And everybody will be carrying always with himself his psychoanalyst. Wherever he will move, he will have to carry his psychoanalyst. That is already coming in the West. I have heard in a New York street, two small boys were talking, as they have always talked down the centuries. But what they said was very new. One boy said to the other, "My psychoanalyst can lick your psychoanalyst anytime." Small boys. They have always talked that way, that my father can lick your father. Or my house is bigger than your house. Or my dog is stronger than your dog. A small child's beginning of the ego. But my psychoanalyst can lick your psychoanalyst anytime. This is something new. Three women were talking about their children. One was saying, "He is the topmost in the class. He always comes first." The second said, "That's nothing. My child is only 7, but he can play music like a Mozart, like a Wagner." The third said, "That's nothing, my child is only 5, and he goes to his psychoanalyst all alone." Hypertension is a stage where you have lost balance. You cannot bring your heart to function in your life. Logic has become all, and logic remains superficial. Logic, when it becomes all, creates only anxiety. It never gives any peace. It goes on bringing new problems. It never solves any problem. It cannot solve. It is not in its power. It only pretends. It only promises. It goes on saying that I will deliver the goods, but it never delivers. And then problems go on accumulating. And you don't know how to get out of the problems, because you don't know how to get out of the head. You don't know how to play with children, how to love your woman, how to go and have a talk with the trees, and sometimes have a dialogue with the stars. You have forgotten all. You are no more a poet. You are no more an alive heart. And whenever any part of the body is repressed, that part takes revenge. Another part of the mind is repressed, that part takes revenge. And heart is the most vital part, the most fundamental part. One can live without head, but one cannot live without heart. Head is a little superficial. It is a kind of luxury. But heart is very essential. Head exists only in man. It cannot be very essential. Animals live without it and live perfectly well in a far silent and blissful way than men. Trees live without the head, and the birds, and the children, and the mystics. Head is superficial. It has a certain function. Use it, but don't be used by it. Once you are being used by it, you will become anxious, anxiety will come, and life will become nauseous. It will be just a long stretched pain. And you will not find any oasis anywhere in it. It will be a desert thing. Remember, the essential has not to be repressed. The non-essential has to follow the essential, has to become its shadow. You cannot deny anything without getting into trouble. Listen to this anecdote. One day, a flying saucer landed in L.C. Gumtree's garden. right in the middle of her summer bloomers, which could have been quite painful if she had been wearing them. There was a whirring sound, and a strange purple man appeared through the hatch in the side of the saucer. Straight away, he headed for Elsie's back door and knocked politely. Elsie opened the door and, quickly taking in the situation, said, "Are you from the flying saucer?" Replied the man, as though in pain. "Are you from Mars?" Elsie asked. Went the man again, his face contorted. "How long did it take you to get here?" 10 years, asked Elsie. 20 years? Said the man, an agonizing look on his face. 20 years? You have been all that time in your flying saucer? Nodded the man furiously. "What can I do for you?" asked Elsie. The little man opened his mouth and with great difficulty said, "Can I use your toilet, please?" Deny anything, and it becomes overpowering. Now for 20 years, he has not been able to find a toilet. And you are asking nonsense questions, from where you are coming and who are you and how many. How can he answer all these things? His denied part is there with a vengeance. Your heart is denied for so many lives that when it erupts, it is going to create great chaos in your life. First you suffer from the mind, its tensions, anxieties, and then you can suffer from the explosion of the heart. That's what when a man breaks down. First he suffers from the tense state of the mind, and then one day the heart takes its revenge, erupts, and the man goes mad, goes berserk. Both the situations are bad. First the sanity was too much, that created the insanity. A really sane person is one who can live between sanity and insanity in absolute balance. A real sane person has always some insanity in him. He accepts it. A real rational person is one who respects irrationality too, because life is such. If you cannot laugh because of your reason, because laughter is ridiculous, then you are bound for troubles. You are destined for troubles. Yes, logic is good, laughter too is good. And laughter brings balance. It is good to be serious, it is good to be non-serious too. And there should be a constant balancing. Have you seen a tightrope walker? He continuously balances himself. Sometimes he leans to the left on his staff, and then he comes to a point where if he leans a single moment more, he will fall. He immediately changes his balance, goes to the other side, to the right, leans to the right. Then again a moment comes, that one single moment more, and he will be gone. He again starts leaning to the left. That's how he proceeds, leaning to the left, to the right. He keeps in between. That's the beauty. Leaning to the left and to the right, leaning to both the extremes, he keeps in between. If you want to keep yourself in between, you will have to lean to both the sides again and again. You are not to choose. If you choose, you will fall. If you have chosen the head, you will fall. You will go hypertense. If you choose the heart and forget the head completely, you will become mad. And if you want to choose anyhow, if you want to choose, then choose being mad choose the heart because it is more essential. But I am not saying that choose. If you insist and you say, I have to choose, then be mad rather than be just dry and sane. Be of the heart. Love. Love madly. Sing. Sing madly. Dance. Dance madly. That is far better than just becoming calculating, logical, rational, and just suffering nightmares. But I am not saying that is not my suggestion that you do that. My suggestion is remain choiceless. Choiceless awareness is the key word. Remain choiceless, aware, and whenever you see something is going out of balance, lean to the other side. Bring the balance again, and this is how one moves. Life is like tightrope walking. The third question, what did Jesus really do with Mary Magdalene? Shiva, no personal questions, please. The fourth question, how can I stop wanting to be special? Because you are special and there is no need to be special. You are special. You are unique. God never creates anything less than that. Everyone is unique, utterly unique. There has been no person like you before. And there will never be a person like you again. God has taken this form first time and the last time. So there is no need to try to become special. You already are. If you are trying to be special, you will become ordinary. Your very effort is rooted in misunderstanding. It will create confusion. Because when you try to become special, one thing you have taken for granted that you are not special. You have become ordinary already. You have missed the point. Now, once you have taken it for granted that you are ordinary, how you can become special? You will try this way and that, and you will remain ordinary. Because your base, your foundation is wrong. Yes, you can go to the dressmaker and can find more sophisticated dresses. You can have your hair style done again. You can use cosmetics. You can learn few things and become more knowledgeable. You can paint and start thinking that you are a painter. You can do few things. You can become famous or notorious. But deep down, you will know that you are ordinary. All these things are on the outside. How can you transform your ordinary soul into an extraordinary soul? There is no way. And God has not given any way because He never makes ordinary souls. So He could not think about your problem. He has given you a special, extraordinary soul. He has never given it to anybody. This is just made for you. What I would like to say to you, Shaila, is recognize your speciality. There is no need to get it. It is already there. Recognize. Go into yourself and feel. Nobody's thumbprint is like you. Not even the thumbprint. Nobody's eyes are like you. Nobody's sound is like you. Nobody's flavor is like you. You are absolutely exceptional. There is not a double to you anywhere. Even two twins are different. However alike they look, they are different. They go different ways. They grow different ways. They attain to different kinds of individualities. This recognition is needed. You ask, how can I stop wanting to be special? Just listen to the facts. Just go into your being and see. And the effort to be special will disappear. When you will know you are special, the effort will disappear. If you want me to give you some technique so that you can stop being special, then that technique will disturb. Again you are trying to do something. Again you are trying to become something. First you were trying to become special. Now you are trying not to become special. But trying, improving in some way or other. But never accepting the you that you are. My whole message is, accept the you that you are, because God accepts it. God respects it, and you have not respected your being yet. Be immensely happy that God has chosen you to be, that God has chosen you to exist, to see His world, to listen to His music, to see His stars, to see His people. Love and be loved. What more you want? Rejoice. I say again and again, rejoice in it. And in that very rejoicing, by and by, one day, it will explode to you like a lightning that you are special. But remember, that will not come as an ego. That you are special against others. No. In that moment you will know everybody is special. The ordinary exists not. So this is the criterion. If you think I am special, special then to that man, special to then to that woman, then you have not understood yet. It is the ego game. It's special not comparatively. Special not in comparison with anybody. Special just as you are. A Zen master was asked. A professor had come to see him. And the professor asked, why I am not like you? This is my desire. Why I am not like you? Why I am not silent like you? Why I am not wise like you? The master said, you wait. You sit silently. Watch. Watch me and watch yourself. And when everybody else is gone, if still the question remains, I will answer. And the whole day people were coming and going and disciples asking. And the professor was getting very, very restless. Time is wasted. And this man says, when everybody is gone, then came evening and there was nobody. And the professor said, now enough is enough. I have been waiting for the whole day. What about my question? And the moon was rising. It was a full moon night. And the master said, have you not got the answer yet? The professor said, but you never answered me. The master laughed. He said, I have been answering the whole day. To many people, if you had watched, you would have understood. But come out. Let us go in the garden. And in the garden, the full moon is there. and it is a beautiful night. And the master says to him, look at this cypress tree, a big cypress tree, standing high, almost touching the moon. The moon is intertwined in its branches. And look at this small bush. But the prophet says, what are you talking about? Have you forgotten my question? The master said, I am answering your question. This bush and this cypress tree have lived for years into my garden. I have never heard the bush asking the cypress tree, why I am not like you? And I have not heard the cypress tree to ask the bush, why I am not like you? The cypress tree is the cypress tree, and the bush is the bush, and they both are happy in being themselves. I am myself, you are you. The comparison brings conflict. The comparison brings ambition. And the comparison brings imitation. If you ask why I am not like you, then you will start trying to be like me, and that will be the undoing of your whole life. You will become an imitator, a carbon copy. And when you are an imitator, you will lose all respect for yourself. It is very rare to find a person who respects himself. Why it is so rare? Why is not there reverence for life, your own life? And if it is not for your own life, how it can be for others? If you don't respect your own being, how can you respect the rose bush and the cypress tree and the moon and the people? How can you respect your master, your father, your mother, your friend, your wife, your husband? How can you respect your children if you have not respected yourself? And it is very rare to find a person who respects himself. Why it is so rare? Because you have been taught to imitate. From the very childhood it has been told to you, become like Christ or become like Buddha. But why? Why you should become like Buddha? Buddha never became you. Buddha was Buddha. Christ was Christ. Krishna was Krishna. Why you should become like Krishna? What wrong you have committed? What sin you have committed that you should become like Krishna? God never created another Krishna. He never created another Buddha, another Christ, never. Because he does not like to create the same things again and again. He is a creator. He is not an assembly line. One Ford comes, another Ford, Ford cars go on coming all alike on the assembly line. God is not an assembly line creator. He never creates the same. And the same will not be valuable. Just think a Krishna again walking. The same type of man. He will look like a joker. He can get only some place in a circus, nowhere else. He will say again the Gita whether Arjuna is available or not. Whether the Mahabharata, that great war is happening or not, but he will have to repeat his Gita. And he will walk in his clothes and they will look very odd. Just think of Jesus again amidst you. He will not fit. He will be out of date. He will be antique. He will be only useful in a museum. Nowhere else. God never repeats. But you have been taught to become somebody else. Always become somebody else. The neighbor's son. Become like the neighbor's son. Look how intelligent he is. Look that girl. How graceful she walks. Be like that. You have been taught always to be like somebody else. Nobody has told you, be yourself. and be respectful to your being. It is a God's gift. Never imitate. That's what I say to you. Never imitate. Be yourself. That much you owe to God. Be yourself. Be authentically yourself. And then you will know that you are special. God has loved you so much. That's why you are. That's why you are in the first place. Otherwise you would not have been. It is indicative of His tremendous love for you. But your speciality has no comparison with anybody. It is not that you are special in comparison to your neighbors, friends, your wife, husband. You are simply special because you are alone. Just like yourself, you are the only person. In that respect, in that understanding, efforts to become a special will disappear. All your efforts to become a special are like putting legs on a snake. You will kill the snake. You think because of compassion you are putting legs on the snake. Poor snake, how he will walk without legs? Just as if the snake has fallen in the hands of a centipede. And the centipede has great compassion on the snake. And he thinks, poor snake, I have 100 legs and he has none. How he will walk? At least few legs he needs. And if he operates and puts few legs on the snake, he will kill the snake. The snake is perfectly okay as he is. He need not have any legs. You are perfectly okay as you are. This is what I call respect towards one's own being. And to respect oneself has nothing to do with ego, remember. To respect oneself is not self-respect. To respect oneself is God's respect. It is to respect the Creator, because you are just a painting, His painting. Respecting the painting, you respect the painter. Respect, accept, recognize, and all those foolish efforts to be special will disappear. The fourth question, what is the difference between mind and ego? Bhagavan uses mind without ego, so they can't be the same. Is mind only dangerous when it is working on the past or future? I would be happy to find no ego, but I don't want to drop my mind like a banana peel on the road for other people to slip on and or for buffaloes to eat. Neeraj, buffaloes are not so foolish. If you throw your mind like a banana peel, no buffalo is going to eat it. Yes, there is a possibility some man may swallow it. That much stupidity exists only in man. Buffaloes are not interested in minds at all. They are perfectly okay mindlessly. But mind and ego are not synonymous. Ego is the illness of the mind. Ego means a ill mind. Non-ego means a healthy mind. Ego is a constriction, a limitation on the mind. When the ego disappears, mind becomes mind with a capital M. In Buddhist literature, they use mind in two ways. Mind with a small lowercase m and mind with a capital M. The capital M mind is cosmic mind. The ego has disappeared. The whole has taken possession of you. You have surrendered. You are no more. God is. And the lowercase M mind is you, the ego. It is against God. It separates you. It is like an earthen pot. You take the earthen pot to the river. You fill the earthen pot with water. The pot is underneath the water. The water inside the pot is the same and the outside the pot is the same. But there is a wall, earthen wall dividing. The wall disappears. Then again, the inside of the pot and the outside of the pot is one. Ego is like a wall, earthen wall, that surrounds you and divides you from God. It is not the mind that is the question. The question is the ego. But you don't know any other mind. You know only this ego mind. So when I am talking to you and I say to you, drop the mind, I mean drop the ego. When you have dropped this mind, the ego mind, then the cosmic mind arises in you. Then you start functioning, not from your own. You start functioning from the original source. Then God functions through you. Beware of the ego. Sometimes, even the idea of God can be used by the ego. One man came to me. He had a big suitcase with him. He opened the suitcase and there were many files and he said, now look, God comes every day to me in the night and he gives me messages. And in the middle of the night I have to write messages. He was a Mohammedan. And Mohammedans were very angry because he was saying the next Quran is descending on me just as it descended 1,000 years before on Muhammad. A higher dispensation is coming to me. I looked in his files. They were all rubbish. There was not a single word of any significance. But that man had come to me. He wanted me to recognize that he is a prophet, that God has spoken through him. That here is the proof. And he said, I know nobody else will recognize, but you will recognize me. Now he had come with great hope. And I felt great compassion for him. He was in a very, very ill state. He was almost schizophrenic. One part of his mind was befooling another part of the mind. One part was saying things to the other part, and the other part was writing. No, he was not deceiving anybody. He was himself deceived. But the ego was feeling very good, that God has chosen him to be a special messenger. The ego can even play with the idea of God. It can claim to be God. It can claim God's realization. One has to watch very carefully because the ego and its games are very subtle. It is related of Bernard Shaw that he once opened his front door to find himself face to face with two earnest young men, one of whom had some pamphlets in his hands. Who are you and what do you want? Asked Shaw. We are Jehovah's Witnesses, said one of them. Really? Replied Shaw. I am Jehovah. How are we doing? Now he is simply joking. But this is how the ego functions. It happened in Baghdad. A man was caught because he has declared himself a prophet of God. He was thrown in jail. After 7 days, the Khalif went to see the man. For 7 days he had been kept starving, had been beaten continuously, and he was tied to a pole, swollen, scratched all over the body, very badly beaten, starving, dirty. The Khalif asked him, "Now what do you think? Do you still think that you are the prophet of God? Because there is only one God and there is only one prophet, Muhammad. So you take your statement back, otherwise you will be killed." The man started laughing and he said, "But when I was coming from God, when he appointed me as the prophet, he had told me that you will be tortured, that people will beat you, just as in old days they had done with other prophets. They will insult you, they will kill you, as they have done with Jesus. So your beating, this jail, and all this torture simply proves that I am a prophet. It does not disprove a thing. So I was right. In fact, I was thinking so many days have passed and nobody is beating me and nobody is torturing me. Am I a prophet or not? You proved it, that I am a prophet." And just then another man who was tied to another pole, he started laughing very loudly. And the Khalif asked, "Why you are laughing? What is the matter with you?" And the man said, "This man is a liar. I am God myself, and I have never sent this man. He was caught 1 month before because he had declared himself to be God himself. And I am not saying that there have not been people who have become God. Mansur was right when he declared, 'Anal Haq, I am God.' The seers of Upanishads were right when they declared, 'Aham Brahmasmi, I am God.' Jesus is right when he says, 'My Father in heaven and I are one and the same. If you have seen me, you have seen my Father.' But it is a very delicate matter because pretenders are there, egoists are there, egomaniacs are there. You have to be very careful. You have to watch. You have to see into yourself so no ego starts claiming. When the ego has disappeared, when you have become just emptiness, a nothingness, then the voice of God starts floating through you. That is cosmic mind. Ego and mind are not synonymous. In you they are. Right now they are. But if ego is dropped, then a totally new quality of mind arises in you, which has nothing to do with you, which has existed before you, which is eternity. That's what Jesus means when he says, 'Before Abraham was, I am.' He is saying Abraham as the ego, as the personality. And when he says, 'Before Abraham was, I am,' he is using the word 'I am' as cosmic mind. I can say to you, 'Before Jesus was, I am.' Then I is no more used in the sense of ego. It is just a linguistic way to say that the eternal precedes the temporal. that the formless precedes the form, that the nameless precedes the name, that the egoless precedes the ego. You are right. Mind and ego are not the same. But don't get deceived by the idea. It can be dangerous. It can prove fatal. In you, they are same. You drop the ego. Just peel it like a banana peel. And throw it. And don't throw it on the road. Because that's true. Somebody can slip on it. You have been slipping on it for so many lives. And don't throw it on the road. As far as I know, no buffalo will eat it, but who knows? Some buffalo may have become stupid living with man too long, and may eat it, and may get into trouble. The fifth question, are not we punished for our sin? No. We are punished by our sin, not for our sin. Sin itself is its punishment. You overeat, you suffer. You overindulge, you suffer. It is not that the suffering will come later on. That suffering will come as a result. No. Suffering comes in the act itself. So let me tell it in this way. We are punished by our sin, not for our sin. That for has created great difficulties for man. Because for means in future, maybe in the other life. Who bothers about the future? And we will see when it comes. And some way and means can be found to avoid it. Or we can always go to the priest and confess. Or we can go to the Ganges and take a bath and be relieved of the sin. Or we can go to a saint and be blessed by him. Some strategy can be found. But I tell you, you are not punished for sin. You are punished by sin, so there is no way to get rid of it. If you eat too much, you go against nature, and immediately the punishment. The punishment is instantaneous. It is not afterwards. It is then and there. It is immediate. So nobody can avoid it. If you want to avoid it, you have to be very, very conscious not to commit sin. Sin is a kind of unconsciousness. You become angry. In that very anger you suffer. Not that you will suffer afterwards. Anger is fire. Anger is poison. It poisons your whole system. It disturbs your health. It disturbs your mind. It disturbs your tranquility. It disturbs your soul. And then it hangs with you for days together. The disturbance has to settle again. And before it settles, you become angry again. Then it becomes chronic. Then it hangs with you. My approach is that in the very act is the punishment. And in the very act is the reward, obviously. When you are loving, there is heaven. When you are hateful, there is hell. The sixth question, I want to serve people, is not that right? It depends. It depends on you. If you have come home, if you have become that which is your destiny, if your own problems have disappeared, if you don't have any more anxiety, any more desires, any more unconsciousness. Then there is no need to ask the question. Service will flow from you. It will overflow. It will be a constant sharing, not deliberate. It will be very natural, spontaneous. Wherever the need will arise, you will be in service. If somebody is drowning in the river, you will jump. If somebody's house is on fire, you will rush with water. If somebody has fallen on the road, you will help him to get up back. But these all things will not be deliberate. Not that you will plan. Not that you will seek for these situations. Not that you will get out of your house thinking where to serve, how to serve people. You will live your life. And if some situation arises, you will respond to it with no plan. You will never become a servant. You will be always of service, but you will never become a servant. These public servants are mischievous people. Never become a public servant. These are the people who have been creating trouble for man. And sometimes when you are a public servant, you go on serving whether the other person likes it or not. I have heard one school in Manchester had a kennel running alongside the playground. One day, two little boys came running into the headmaster's office in a state of great agitation. "Sir, sir," said the first one, "Bobby Armstrong fell in the kennel." "Good heavens," said the headmaster. "Did you get him out?" "Yes, sir." "Did you give him artificial respiration?" "We tried to, sir, but he kept getting up and running away." I have heard about a missionary who told to his children in the Sunday school that help people. One child asked how, what we should do. So he just, for example, said, "If some old woman wants to cross the street, help her." After 7 days, he asked next Sunday, "Did you help somebody?" 3 hands were raised. He asked the first, "What you did?" He said, "I helped one old woman to cross the street." The priest was very happy and said, "God will bless you. This is very good." He asked the other, "What you did?" He said, "I also helped an old woman to cross the street." A little suspicion arose in the priest's mind that they both got two old women, but old women are there, they can get. It is not such a big thing. He asked the third, and the third also said, "I helped an old woman to cross the street." Then it was too much. He said, "You all three got three old women?" They said, "Who is saying three? It was only one woman." The priest was more puzzled. He said, "Then, three boys were needed to help the woman to cross?" He said, "Even three, it was difficult because he did not want to cross. It was so difficult, sir, but we anyhow did it. We carried her to the other side." Never become a deliberate public servant. Service should come as a natural growth of your meditation. Otherwise, you can be dangerous. One man asked Buddha, "I would like to serve people." Buddha looked at him and became very sad. He said, "But why you are looking so sad? Suddenly, why you became so sad?" Buddha said, "You are not. How can you serve people? First be. Otherwise, in the name of service, you will do some harm. You are not yet beyond harm. You are carrying much poison in you. If you start serving people, your poison will spread." It happened, the chaplain of a large London hospital was doing his rounds of the wards when he came across a Chinese, desperately ill, in a side ward. He was in an oxygen mask and looked close to death's door. The chaplain leaned over him and said, "How are you feeling, old chap?" The reply was necessarily muffled. However, It sounded so frantic and urgent that the chaplain asked him to repeat it, but he could not understand what the unfortunate man was trying to tell him. And then, to his distress, the Chinese, obviously suffering acutely, expired before his very eyes. He was haunted by this last word from a poor, lonely man in a foreign land, friendless and unable to communicate. So he sought out a professor of Oriental languages and repeated the man's last phrase as exactly as he could remember it. "Now," pleaded the chaplain, "what was he trying to tell me? What did he say?" "He said," the professor answered, "you are standing on my oxygen pipe." And the last question, Bhagwan, they say that when drunk, the Englishman tends to boast, the Irishman to fight, and the Scotsman to go to sleep in case he is asked to buy a round of drinks. Now I want to know, what do you say about an Indian? There is no difficulty. The question is very simple. When an Indian is drunk, he delivers a little spiritual discourse. Minimum time limit, 90 minutes. Enough for today.